My name is Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Bob.
Because of God's grace that I've accessed and maintained through the program and fellowship Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink or anything else to treat my alcoholism except AA since Halloween 1978, and for that I owe AA my life. Good morning. Somebody would mention before the meeting that said, well, there's not that many people showing up. I'm surprised anybody shows up for a traditions workshop. I understand it. When I was new, I don't think I would have got tradition. It's funny. Last year I did a workshop on the traditions at a conference in Chicago, and they build it spiritual principles and relationships, and 900 and some people showed up. Because you know how we are. Traditions, I want stuff that has to do with me. Right? Oh. I'm in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And how could you not, if you're involved and you're making amends and you're repairing the damage and you're getting your parents and people in your life back, and you're fixing those impossible, irreparable relationships through this amazing process in AA, and you're returning to society, and you're sponsoring people, and you're watching them, homeless guys, buy their first house, and guys that were so depressed and alone they'd never be free, and they're sponsoring guys in the lights on. And you walk guys down the aisle and watch them have their first kid. And you watch what happens. I had a mother that come back into my life that I ended. I loved her, always did, and a sister and a father, and all through Alcoholics Anonymous. How could you not love the thing that's making that possible? I mean, how could you not, really? And God, the things that I've seen happen in the guys' lives that I sponsor, guys that have been in my life, some of them over 25 years. And but it wasn't always that way with me. I came here, I was so self-obsessed. I think I was in AA 6 months before I realized there was anybody else here except me. No, I mean, really, because it was all my stuff. It was like you were just cardboard cutouts for me to throw things at, you know, in my life. And then I started to connect with some of the people here and realize that they were, I started to identify and realize that they were like me. And I started to care about the things that were going on in their life. And then I started sponsoring guys. And my consciousness expanded out off of me and eventually into the fellowship, Alcoholics Anonymous. I belong to a home group, and I really care about the people there. Some of them annoy the hell out of me, I'll tell you, but I care about them. And if there's nobody in AA annoying you, you're not going to enough meetings. I mean, you're not doing nothing. You're just sitting at home. I mean, but how else do we learn love and tolerance and how to deal with that stuff, really? And you know that I'm not an expert on anything, probably except my own failure. But I'm going to try to share a little bit about my personal experience in the application of these principles. And I'm going to do a little bit, and then Sandy's going to tie it up. And I tell you, I'm so, and I don't want to embarrass Sandy, because if I was, it would reverse to embarrass me. But I want to tell you, God has gifted him with an ability to communicate the things that people like me think. And since my early sobriety, I've listened to him talk. I've shared many, many, many times, and I've always just, it's just one of my favorite guys to listen to. I kind of feel like starting this, I feel like the garage band opening for the Rolling Stones, you know. That's enough. I'm not going to embarrass him anymore. That's enough. You know, some of you might be wondering, well, why? What's the big deal? Why do we have to have these traditions, these rules, this stuff? And If you know anything about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it took me a while to even care about it, but I started, as I fell in love with AA, I started to want to know about how we got here. What happened? And most of you know the story of Bill and Bob meeting in the Cyberling Gatehouse in 1935, May, and how Bill had been sober almost 6 months with no success. And he'd had a talk with a guy named with William Silkworth before this trip to Akron. He got a little new idea and he started a new approach. And he started sharing with this washed-up proctologist, a guy that I have always identified with. Matter of fact, when Bill wanted to talk to him, he couldn't talk to him at the moment. He was taking a nap under the dining room table. You gotta love a guy like that, you know? I mean, right, you really do. I mean, I get that. I'm under the booth taking a nap kind of guy. You know, I'm just that kind of guy. I understand that. And they met the next day, and Bob's son and I became very good friends. He's been in my house. He died a while back, and he was a great man. I used to love to sit in rooms and listen to him tell the story of Ann, Bob's wife, dragging him in the car, and the kid Smitty's sitting in the back, and taking him to see this Yankee, and he don't want to go. He don't want some Yankee telling him about his drinking. He's had people preaching to him about his drinking for years. And he walked in there, and an amazing thing happened. He said to him, he said, 15 minutes, I want to get out. You got to get me out of here. 15 minutes, that's it. I'll take it for 15 minutes. We came out 4 hours later, almost. And because he went in there, and Bill Wilson did not talk to Dr. Bob about Dr. Bob's drinking. Bill Wilson talked to Dr. Bob about Dr. Bob's drinking. And Bill just sat there, and his defenses were down because he wasn't being talked at. And for the first time, he connected with another human being. And he was enthralled with the whole prospect. And Bill had these principles that were kind of, he was trying to flesh out that would eventually be the 12 steps. And there was about six of them at that time. And he loved them all. He loved the God thing. He loved the God deal. He loved the confession of shortcomings. He loved helping others. He wasn't big on this amends thing, though. I mean, it was just seemed a little extreme. He kind of dug his heels in. Well, you know, you got to understand, Bill. I've almost ruined my reputation in this town already. I'm not gonna. And he wouldn't do that. He dug his heels in. Consequently, he drank again. And he came back from a medical convention so drunk that the conductor didn't know what to do with him. They laid him on the platform at the Akron station off the train. And his office manager came down, and they eventually ended up back at the Ardmore House. Bill was living there, staying there, because Bill wasn't real flush financially. It was just convenient that Bob got sober, actually. And he came to on what most historians believe was the morning of June 10th, 1935. And he came to like I've come to off of an extended drunk, you know, with the shakes and wanting to jump out of my skin and just in the anguish and the remorse and just falling apart. And he said, what day is it? And he said, well, it's June 10th. And he said, no, it can't be June 10th. And he had a surgery to perform on the morning of June 10th. And Dr. Bob's a proctologist. He can use your imagination of what kind of surgery it might have been. He's shaking like this. Imagine being the patient laying on the gurney watching your doctor come in like And Bill gave him his last drink and sent him into the surgery. And he gave him his last drink and a sedative because he didn't know what else to do. I mean, the guy was coming apart at the seams. And he went into that surgery and performed that operation. And we don't really know what happened to the patient. We know he lived. That's all. I have a friend who's spent his whole sobriety, 20-some years, as trying to be an historian, and went back to the Akron Hospital, actually looked through the records trying to find more information about this guy. wanting to know what happened to him. And I'd like to know. I mean, we know he lived, but I mean, did he whistle when he walked or what? I mean, we don't know. We don't know what happened, how that went. We just know the guy lived. And Dr. Bob came out of that surgery late that morning and disappeared. And Bill and Ann thought he'd probably went and got drunk. He came home just about midnight, and something was different about him. And he went out and he searched out every person he could find that he was afraid to approach, and approached him and started to mend that separation between him and those people and get free. And consequently, Dr. Bob Smith never drank again the rest of his natural life. And low estimates is that he personally helped 5,000 people. And how many people did they help that helped people that helped people that helped people? And I think most of us are sitting in this room indirectly as a result of this man, the second member of Alcoholics Anonymous, finally getting sober. And they started doing 12-step work, and eventually Bill went back to Akron, and the fellowship didn't grow very much. As a matter of fact, when 1939, which is 4 years later when the big book was published, which was a turning point in AA, one of them, they say in the foreword to the first 100 members, it wasn't really 100. It's low estimates, 70 some to 83. It was kind of in there. Historians have really tried to research that. I know guys that they give you different figures, but it wasn't really 100. But he said 100, and I know why he said 100, because I'm that kind of guy. I would have said, oh, it sounds better. I mean, it's not. That's not lying. It's creative. I mean, it's just a. I'm that kind of disposition myself. And AA hadn't grown too much, and they published the big book, and that some people came in as a result of that. I remember hearing a guy when I first got sober from California, one of the earlier members, talk about how they got sober off the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in California because they didn't have a connection with New York and Akron and different parts of the country where that happened. So the big book started, the fellowship started growing, and then a couple things happened. There was a baseball player in Cleveland who was interviewed, and he mentioned that he was sober in AA and it changed his life. And all of a sudden, the Cleveland group of Alcoholics Anonymous was inundated with they were swarmed. And then the thing that probably put us on the map, one of the things anyway, was that there was a guy named Jack Alexander who was an investigative reporter, a no-nonsense kind of guy, a guy that couldn't be bought off. A guy that no crap, and he somebody said to him, look at this AA thing, and he said, yeah, I mean, there's got to be a scam going on there somewhere. Somebody's getting a toaster for helping these people or something, right? And he was one of those kind of go in and dig out the truth kind of guys. He exposed a minister, and he exposed some corruption in one of the unions, and it's that kind of guy. And he went in there, and he went to us, and he started looking at us, and to his, I imagine, in his business, delight and amazement that we weren't anything that he thought he'd find. We were exactly what we said we were. There was nobody here profiting from this, that we just were people who were dying of alcoholism that knew that we had to help others. For fun, as Chuck used to say, for fun and for free. And he wrote this article in the Saturday Evening Post. One of my sponsees gave me an original when I have it at home, and it's an amazing article. And Alcoholics Anonymous was flooded with requests for help, flooded. There was a gal in California, I think Larry probably knew her, that I'd met on several occasions, named Sybil. She's one of the first women in AA to ever get sober, at least the first one west of the Rockies. And she came to Alcoholics. The Alcoholics Anonymous at that time was so flooded with requests for help that when she got to AA, she's not even done shaking yet. And they gave her a stack of letters from women and told her to go out and start helping them. And Sybil never drank again the rest of her life. And AA started growing, and with its growing came a lot of growing pains and a lot of insanity. And there was huge bickering, going on, and one little group's having judgments against another group, and you know, and we're doing it. The Akronites had it right, and the New York people were crazy, and the New York people thought the Akron people were backward, and their day is gonna never get anywhere unless they change. And a lot of bickering, a lot of stuff going on. They had no traditions. They had no principles. Everybody shooting from the hip. All they have is the steps. I have a letter, and I didn't bring it with me at home, written in 1941, it's from the Executive Committee of Alcoholics Anonymous in the Los Angeles area, written to a woman by the name of Irma Livoni. And one of the guys that signed it was a guy I knew, Al Marino. He died years ago. He was one time one of the older members of AA still alive in the California area. And in this letter, they revoked Irma's membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. I talked to Sybil's daughter, and Sybil had told, used to tell the story, and they revoked it because Irma liked men. She liked all kinds of men, single men, married men. She don't care. She doesn't like men. She was very flirtatious, and they thought this is a travesty. This is going to ruin alcoholics, and they revoked her membership. I mean, some of the most dynamic women in AA that I know they wouldn't have been allowed to be here. I mean, I tell you, if my daughter ever ended up... my daughter ever ended up an alcoholic, she is so far so good, but if she ever did need help, I'd probably send her to one of those fallen women. We are not saints. And weird stuff started happening like that, and there's all this craziness going on, and a guy from the Carolinas wrote a letter submitted to the Grapevine, and Bill saw it, and he talked about the Washingtonians, and Bill had never heard of the Washingtonians, and he did some research, and he discovered that there was a group that started in Maryland in the mid-1800s, and without public transportation or telephones or any of the modern stuff that we have today as far as communication, just one alcoholic trying to help another, and just a half dozen years, they grew to tremendous proportions. It's really unclear how big they actually got. Some people say that the low estimates are 100,000. You know, in 6 years, AA was barely over 100. High estimates are maybe close to a half million or a quarter million. Nobody knows for sure, but they were huge. They grew so fast, and they started all this bickering and confusion, and they started back in other stuff, and one of the worst things they did is they started getting involved in the temperance movement, and within they didn't even make the decade, and they fell apart. And here, Alcoholics Anonymous in the mid 1940s is a decade old, and we're falling apart, and we're dying, and Bill's scared, and everybody, and there's people getting drunk, and craziness happening. And Bill thought, my God, this is the same. We're doing the same thing. And in the history of the human race, there's never been anything like us. We have existed the longest to this date, and more alcoholics have been able to find lives as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous than anything in human history. And Bill's, we're losing it. We're falling apart. And he wrote a set of what he called originally the tenets to ensure AA's future, which later became known as the long form. They weren't known as the long form at that time because there was no short form. I mean, they were just it was the deal. And for the next couple years, Bill tried to get the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous to adopt him, or at least to read them in the meeting. He couldn't even get people to read them. And I understand why. I mean, we read them at my home group once a month. And the problem with what's now called the long form is that they're long. I mean, they're very, they read them at the beginning of the meeting. They're long. And in my home group, I will, every, the first Thursday when they read it, you watch the newcomers roll their eyes. Oh. You know, and I understand the early members. Ah, we don't want that. We don't want to read that. That's taking away too much time that should be used with stuff to do with me, right? I understand that. I'm perfect. I'm on that. I get it. But we're in trouble. And there's pressure on, and Bill eventually, some guys started throwing out some ideas on how to abbreviate them. One of the guys was a guy from the early Grapevine, and the pressure was on, and Bill agreed to be part of this abbreviated version and to put out, hoping to get people to at least read them. And they've started publishing them in a series of Grapevine articles, and in the 1950s, they created a conference, which has been become our international, and they created it to cement or try to put the traditions in place in the fellowship. And as a result, we are still here. As a result, in 1978, when I was standing on a bridge trying to get up enough courage to take my own life, there was somewhere for me to go. The result was that when the student was ready, there was still teachers breathing. And my life got saved as a result of it. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I after a while here, I started to get into these traditions. The first time I really looked at them was I was at a meeting, and I did something, and some old-timer jumped on me. So that's against the traditions. I don't even know what the traditions are. But I'm going to find out because I want to be the – if anybody's be jumping on somebody, it's going to be me. I'm the kind of guy that the cat scratches me, and a week later I kick the dog, right? I'm that kind of guy, right? So I want to be the guy that says, hey, you're not – you know. And I don't want to get no more flack, so I want to start learning. I started reading about the traditions, and I got involved in general service and started going to a lot of panels and workshops on the traditions, and I started to really see the amazing spiritual principles that are embodied in this. You know, I think that there's a cause and effect in the universe. I think that when the spirit of an individual gets sick, everything in his life follows along. And when the spirit of a group or a business or a family or a committee or anything, the spirit gets sick, everything else involved with them follows along. And I don't think I think the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are designed to save my life and keep me from killing me, and the traditions are designed to keep us from killing each other. It allows us to function and get along here. And I've tried to apply these. I sold a business, successful business, did very well, sold it, retired very comfortably. Young, a couple years ago, and that business was run by the 12 traditions. You could talk to the members of my staff who are still working there today, that some of them that are working for the new owners, and they don't know what they're called, but they know the principles because we used to talk about them in the staff meetings a lot, about common welfare, about our purpose, about putting principles of the business ahead of our own personalities and what we want. I believe that business did well because of those traditions. I started realizing that the traditions are set up a lot like the steps. In the 12 steps, the problem is defined in step one, lack of power and an absolute inability to manage in anything worthwhile in here, drunk or sober. I can't fix me. And as you go through the process of the 12 steps, by the time you get to step 12, the solution has occurred. And what is that solution? You've had an awakening. Something's happened to you. And the same thing is true with the 12 traditions. In the first tradition, the problem is defined in a lack of unity. It said in the short form, it says our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. I was in a halfway house in 1970, late 76, I think, early 77, and I had a running mate in there, a guy that we used to go, we hated AA, and we'd go to AA meetings, and we'd sit in the back and judge everybody. And you got to have a running partner if you want to judge properly. You need that to get that torque on the personalities. You know, we'd sit back there and talk to you, ah, this guy's full of crap, ah, you know, just all that stuff. Really a bad influence, a disruptive force in AA. We were both on marijuana maintenance. We knew we can't drink. I mean, we are, it kills us. Yeah, yeah, but we got to do something. And I drank again. And I drank again and got thrown out of that place. And I'm living on the streets like an animal. And I'm dirty. And I got hair down to here. And it's matted. And I got a long pre-ZZ Top beard. And it's, you know, with twigs and stuff. And you know, all the natural. And I would go back up to the place I was thrown out of to panhandle nickels and dimes for another bottle of Richard's Wild Irish Rose. And the guy that was my running partner came out one morning and saw me, and he gave me a couple dollars and a look that cut me, a look that we all see from time to time, that look that's a combination of pity and contempt. You know that look? I hate that look. If I go through the rest of my life and never see that look on another human being's face, I'll tell you I'm overpaid in AA. And unbeknownst to me, this snapped this guy seeing me, because what I guess he saw is he saw his near future coming at him. And I was pathetic. And he went and got a sponsor. Not just a sponsor. He got one of those fanatical, step-talking, grateful-for-everything, God-loving guys. Oh, you know, the ones that just make you crazy if you're sitting there belligerently in a state of untreated alcoholism. Well, oh, you just hate those people. And he got one of those guys. He changed his sobriety date, started getting involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I don't know any of this, but later on that year, I'm in an institution. And I'm sitting in the day room waiting for the do-gooders from AA. Come in, like they always show up. And he's coming, he's leading the pack. And he's got two guys he sponsors with him. And something's different about him. And he's real involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got it that he was recovering and is recovering because he became a part of you. And it was later on in my last drunk, I came off of it. And somehow, I don't know where this came from, somewhere inside of me, I knew I had to be a part of you. I got it that my personal recovery depended upon me being unified with you and a part of you. That I could not stand alone. And the bad part about that for me is that there's only one thing I really don't like about AA. Is it's got people in it. And I don't like people. I'm awkward around people. I feel uncomfortable around people. I try to fit and end up saying stupid things. I'm not good with people. I'm good by myself, I think. I'm crazy, but I'm all right. But I had to become a part of you, and I had to start joining you and doing everything that you did. And oddly enough, as I did everything you did, I started to feel like you felt. I started to be connected like you were connected as a result of taking the actions. And I think at the core of my malady is a lack of unity. I drank alcohol because I didn't fit. I never was connected. I had an inability sober to integrate myself in groups of people. And I felt when I'd sober up, I'd feel like I was dying of loneliness until I would return to drinking again, hoping to be able to come out and play and feel like I'm a part of and laugh and have a good time and be all of that stuff. I drank to fit. I drank because of a lack of unity. And Carl Jung, who's mentioned in AA literature several times, he very influential, actually, indirectly, in some of AA's pieces of the puzzle coming together to allow us to be here. Carl Jung, in a letter to Bill Wilson that he wrote in the early 60s, right before Carl passed, he said to Bill Wilson that he always believed something that he had been afraid to tell Roland Hazard. But he believed that based on his experience in dealing with alcoholics, that he always believed that the alcoholic's thirst for alcohol was a low-level thirst of his being for unity, for connectedness, to be a part of. Or as expressed in, he says, or as expressed in religious medieval terms, a union with God. I drank for connectedness. There were times in my early drinking, man, where I'd get half lit up and I was so a part of, man, I'm the guy. There were times, not only was I connected to a group of people, there were moments where I'd get connected to the universe. Just remember those evenings where you just, about 3 o'clock in the morning, you can finally see the big picture. And you think to yourself, oh, this is what Buddha saw. You know, remember that? You just feel plugged in, man, plugged in. I'd say, at middle of 3 o'clock in the morning, I'd say stuff blow my mind. Just, oh. I drank for unity. And that's really a lack of unity is the problem. It's a problem in my personal life. It's a problem in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a problem in my business. It's a problem in relationships. If there's a problem in a relationship, it's usually this. And so we start through the process that's designed to fix this, to treat this lack of unity, this disconnectedness that we can have as a fellowship or an individual or as a family or as a business or wherever you apply these spiritual principles. Tradition number two is an amazing tradition. AA is so unlike anything else in the world. And it says, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place I know where you come in a big shot and you grow up to being a servant. Right? Everywhere else it's the other way. Every place else, you come in, you scrub the floors, and eventually you're the boss. And newcomers come in, they're the boss, they know what's wrong with everybody, they know what's out of check. And if you're lucky and you apply this stuff, you eventually will become a servant. You'll eventually fall in love with this thing, and you just want to help. How can I help? You need someone to do the chairs? You need somebody to go on a 12-step call. What do you need? We have guys at my group. They come up to me because I'm visible, and which bothers me sometimes. But there's new guys that come into AA, and they're looking for who's in charge. Who's in charge? And if you give them the right answer, they just look at you. Well, God. Yeah, come on, who's really in charge? Because you want to get you want to find that guy and kind of get up next to him, see how you can get his spot. You know, I mean, right. Larry and I were talking about this in the restaurant last night about this vying for control in AA. It's a very disrupting, disunifying deal. Power struggles in Alcoholics Anonymous. Our ultimate authority is a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. And the group, an informed group conscience, I believe, is infallible. It's not always it might not always be your way, but it's the way of something or some force that is greater than us. And isn't the essence of surrendering to AA giving up your way for a greater purpose and a greater ethic? I had a guy that I sponsored. He's sober 21 years. And when he was about 18 years sober, about 17 years sober, he came to me and he was just frazzled. He had one of those days where nothing's going right. And he just wants to, you know, one of those kind of days where he wants to explode. He's just uptight. And we started talking. And he said, man, I just hate it when I get like this. I said, yeah, I know. I said, I hate that feeling that you get when you're not getting your way. He said, yeah, man, I know. I said, well, I think you're sober long enough to hear this. I can tell you how you will never feel that again. How you will never feel that anxious conflict of not getting your way again. And he lit up. He said, really? I said, yeah. He said, what? I said, just don't have a way. And he looked at me like, oh. It's true. Don't have a way. Subjugate your way to the way of a power greater than yourself. Maybe it starts with your sponsor, who is like God's lieutenant until you actually connect with something. Tradition number three. You know, and this thing about our leaders have been trusted servants. I don't know why I remember weird things from my childhood in school, but one of the pieces of English literature I remembered is after I got an AA and I hadn't gone back and read it or anything, was Milton's Paradise Lost. And there's a part in there where Lucifer has literally cast himself out of heaven by his own will. And as he's leaving, he's shaking his fist at God and the angels of heaven. And he says a classic line. He says, I'd rather reign in hell than serve in heaven. And I don't know about you, but when I'm reigning, it feels like hell. And when I'm serving, it feels like heaven. And the whole difference between your experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, or I think anywhere, is are you a guy that's trying to reign or a guy that's trying to serve? And man, if you try one week, you try to be a reigner, at the end of that week, you'll know this ain't no good. And if you try to be a servant, at the end of that week, you'll go, yeah, this is the deal. Tradition number three, and I want to talk a little bit about this in the long form. I don't know. This is I don't want to get into an opinion, but I'll come up with an observation. I think that something changed in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous when we walked away from the long form and we adopted the short form. The membership requirement became different, and consequently, the flavor of the fellowship altered a little bit. In the original membership requirement, as it's outlined in the original tradition, the third tradition, it says our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. Hence, we may refuse none who wish to recover from alcoholism. And it goes on to talking about membership and conformity, and that never has to do with conformity or money, and it's true. But I'll tell you, in the short form, the membership requirement's different. It says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Let me tell you something. In my observation, there's a big difference between having a desire not to drink and suffering from alcoholism, because the suffering from alcoholism begins where the bag in the bottle ends. It's the restless, the irritable, the discontent, the low-level depressions, the feelings of misery and depression, the feelings of uselessness, all the stuff it talks about in the big book on page 52 and in the doctor's opinion and throughout that whole book. It's a description of how guys like me, what is alcoholism once I stop drinking? What do I got to apply these steps to? I'm an everyday member of Alcoholics Anonymous because I suffer from alcoholism. And in direct proportion to my involvement in this spiritual way of life, I don't even know it most time. I'm very comfortable in my life. But if I start diminishing my involvement in AA, I start to suffer from alcoholism again. And it's insidious for me, because when I start to suffer from alcoholism, I don't get it that there's anything wrong with me. What it looks like is there's just a lot of really out of line people around me. And they're irritating me, and I'm restless, so I need to straighten them out. Which makes abstinence a lonely, lonely business. I'm an everyday member of Alcoholics Anonymous because I suffer from alcoholism. I didn't come here with a desire not to drink, really. I had a desire to stop hurting, a desire to stop suffering, a desire to stop ending up in jail, a desire to stop having wine sores, a desire to stop feeling like I'm dying, a desire to stop being homeless, a desire to get away from the remorse and the shame. But to stop drinking, what if God would have come to me when I was new and given me one wish, I think I would have said, let me drink like I drank when I was 18 years old again. Because then alcoholism was a treatment, or alcohol was a treatment for my alcoholism. I came to AA and I'm an everyday member because I suffer from alcoholism. And what happened, I think, in the fellowship as a result of the altering of the membership requirement is that we've opened the doors to anybody who might have a problem with drinking or even think that drinking is probably not a good idea. And everybody on the Atkins diet has a desire not to drink. They don't want the carbohydrates. I mean, and what happened is, this is my view. What seemed to happen in AA is that we now have a percentage of our fellowship that their alcoholism ended where the bottle ended. They don't suffer from alcoholism. They don't really need the steps. And I know guys sober a lot of years, guys that are friends of mine that I like a lot. But they're a different type of alcoholism. They don't need a sponsor. They don't need to help others. They think it's nice. They don't need to write an inventory. A lot of them never worked the steps, and they're fine. They're great social members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Their alcoholism ended where the bottle ended. All they need to do is just don't drink. That Nancy Reagan just say no thing kind of works for them. And they come to AA because now that they're not going to the bars and the parties, they have a little social void in their life. So they come to AA because they want to be with like-minded people on this drinking issue. And to them, Alcoholics Anonymous is like the sober Elks or something. You know, it's like it's a place where they're, oh, it's great. But they don't – what their experience – in abstinence is not my experience. I relapsed for 7.5 years because of untreated alcoholism, because I suffer from alcoholism when I stop drinking. And the suffering from alcoholism is subtle and it grinds away at me until one day, in the face of overwhelming experience, that the worst thing I could ever do would be to take a pill or drink or smoke something and I do it again because I need relief, because I suffer from alcoholism. So I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I sit with the guys I sponsor. Let's try to find out, are you the guy that this book was written for? And if you are, then your life's on the line here. You need to do this stuff. It's not, I mean, if you don't, you're not going to stay sober. That is our experience. Matter of fact, there's 5-6 places in this book it tells you you'll drink again if you don't do this or if you don't do that. I've spent the last almost 28 years, the end of this month, in hospitals and institutions. It's my heart. And in Las Vegas, I'll tell you, there's not a week that goes by I don't see somebody that drank again after many years of sobriety, all from untreated alcoholism. Tradition number 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. This is really where our freedom comes from. Every group has the ability to do anything as long as it doesn't reflect badly on Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when it starts in the long form, it talks about, not in the fourth tradition so much, but it's in the sixth, it talks about our affiliation, that we can do anything we want as long as we don't imply affiliation or endorsement of anything else. That's why an Alcoholics Anonymous can have any format, any group, any format they want. But when they start saying that this is a AA Bible study, that implies affiliation or endorsement of something. And I think that we have to hold the line, or else what will happen is 20 years from now somebody will come into AA and they're not going to know what AA is. It'll be so, and there is a solution. It talks about the unifying force in AA is not so much our suffering as drinking, but that we have a common solution that we can unanimously agree on and join in harmonious and brotherly action. That we should keep Alcoholics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know there's a sentiment in the world that in AA a lot that, well, it's all good. Well, I think the Washingtonians thought it was all good. And the next time you want to go to a Washingtonian meeting, you'll have a hard time finding one. They don't exist anymore. And I don't want my daughter's children, if they end up with that thing that I got, to have nowhere to come. I really don't. Tradition number 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Not only does every group have a primary purpose, I think as an Alcoholics Anonymous member, I do too. And I've watched groups in Alcoholics Anonymous that become inundated with the kind of good old boy thing, and they're a lot of sociability, a lot of camaraderie, but they lose sight of why they're there. And those groups, the spirit of them changes. I think a group of Alcoholics Anonymous is this idea that came in here out of treatment centers, that we're supposed to use AA for self-fulfillment or gratification, as if a meeting should be my personal vehicle to ventilate my feelings, to take the whole group hostage on my personal problem, is nonsense. It's the most self-centered, selfish approach to AA that a guy like me could ever have. Alcoholics Anonymous exists to be a vehicle to help the new people. And I think every group that gets sick because they lose sight of their primary purpose. And I got sick when I was about 18, 19 years sober. I started getting sick because I lost my primary purpose here. And the frightening thing is I didn't even know I was losing it. And what happened to me is happens to a lot of us. I started reaping the rewards of a spiritual way of life. I started getting financially successful. I started owning a lot of property, getting prestige, getting power, or an illusion of it. I came back from a trip to Maui where I stayed at a 4-star hotel on the beach and had an amazing time. I'd rented a Harley for the time I was there. I ate at some of the greatest restaurants. I came home. I sat in my house. I have a big house up on a hill. Looks out over the city of Las Vegas. I had every toy I could buy. I had a brand new Jaguar, this model that just came out. It was the first one in Las Vegas to ever get one. I had a brand new Corvette, a 740IL BMW, two custom Harley Davidsons. Enough money in my bank account that I'd never have to work again the rest of my life. And I was dying. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And I'm depressed. And I'm just got my, no matter what, everything I look at in my life, it ain't no good. Now, I don't know why it ain't no good. It's just the shine has worn off of everything. And there's this big vacancy inside of me that keeps drawing my attention inward. So I'm sinking into a depression. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And I want... A guy in Alcoholics Anonymous said something to me. It snapped me. He said, you know, you still go to meetings. You're on your mouth a lot in AA. He said, but I don't think your primary purpose is helping drunks anymore. He says, I think your primary purpose is you. And I thought, oh my God, when he said that, you know, they say the truth will set you free, but I'll tell you, it'll ruin your day first. And he was right on the money. I don't know how that happened. How does a guy who spent his first probably 15 years of sobriety just on fire, all I cared about was helping other people, and the business stuff was great, but I'm just doing a good job to be a good example, but my real purpose is to be of service. And then all of a sudden, incrementally, now my focus is me, my finances, my toys, my relationships, me, 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 me. And I understood exactly what the problem was, and I threw up my hands. And within a week, I got 2-3 new guys in my car. I've turned up the volume on my commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm back right in the middle again. And I never left. I never stopped going to meetings. But I tell you what, this is, it's pathetic, too, and I hate to even admit this, but I became the kind of sponsor that if you came up to me after a meeting and you had a problem and you're sharing with me your problem, you want to talk about it, I'm just standing there going, yeah, mm-hmm, yeah. Like, as if you hurry up and get this over with so I can get back to the important thing, me. Right? I don't even know I'm that guy, but I'm that guy. I had re-inundated myself with self, and all of a sudden there was a whole bunch of me between me and you, and a whole bunch of me between me and God. And I was, no wonder I'm dying. I'm in the shadow. I've blocked the light. I put too much of me between me and God. I put too much of me between me and you. And I hope to God I never get back into that, to that depth again. I'm always going to have a problem with this self-centeredness. But I hope.
There we go. Well, good morning, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach. I'm an alcoholic. And I've never seen 2,000 people at a traditions workshop. This is, that's really amazing. Bob did a wonderful job of setting up the whole picture of our traditions. And like Bob, I didn't have any interest in them when I was new. But as the years went by, I found I became very interested in AA history, because I got curious, how did this all happen that I got saved? And my interest in AA history changed my mind about history. I was one of these guys growing up, and they'd go, hey, do you want to take a history course? And I'd go, why should I do that? It already happened. Well, why would you be interested in that? I saw no value in history, and now all I read about is history. It is so essential to put the third dimension in everything, to really see what it's all about. I mean, it's the most fascinating thing in the world, and probably the first 45 years of my life, I thought it was a joke. So you can see how our own perspective gets changed in a process of spiritual growth. And it's that change in perspective that makes everything wonderful. As a matter of fact, that's why we drank. It wasn't to change the world, it was to change how we saw it. And you walk into a bar and live in the damnedest world, they're all awful, and about three drinks later you go, now that's more like it. That now things are looking good. It all was a personal transformation inside, and I'm sure these traditions caused a transformation in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we ended up with a very amazing worldwide, been through all kinds of problems, and came out stronger than ever. And that didn't happen by accident, because we people get in arguments all the time with one another. But there's something magic about the traditions, even if they don't seem magic when you read them. And there's something magic about the steps, even though when you read them, you don't see any magic there. What is that? I remember looking at those steps, and my sponsor said, everything you need is right in here. I'm going, well, I've read them for a week. Where is the money step? I don't see it. So I couldn't see the value of the steps until I did them. And we really don't see the traditions until you've been around a while, and then you see them in action, and then they become quite miraculous. So it's hard to express them in a lecture, if you follow what I mean, to capture the power that they have and the importance they have in our own lives. And I think it's the longer we're sober, the more we realize how precious sobriety is and how valuable, because of all the changes that it made in our lives. And we go, wow, this is really a bigger deal than I thought. I thought I was just going to get sober. I didn't know I was going to be transformed, that I was going to actually see the whole purpose of life. I didn't know that was going to happen. I thought I was just going to stop drinking. And you just go, oh my God, this is a much bigger deal than I thought. And so the traditions are. They really are. They're a bigger deal than they might appear as we try to present them. And actually, I'm just going to start with seven and wrap it up. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Now, this was written by people who were broke. Okay, is that a miracle? Hey, we got some money. Somebody wants to leave us $10,000 in their will. What do you think we ought to do? What do you think they ought to do? We're broke. We can barely get the word out. Well, let's see. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Why shouldn't we take the money? Money has a lot of strings attached to it. Let's say, for example, that you are looking for a place to hold an AA meeting. Your group is just bursting at the seams, so you need another location. You can't fit in the room anymore. So you get a little committee, and somebody says, you know, I think our church would love us. Let me go talk to the minister. Talk to the minister, and the minister said, oh, my God, he himself had been praying for an AA group to come to his church because there's a lot of alcoholics in his congregation. And out of the joy of this group requesting it, he goes, you can have it. What night would you like it? We will make our doors available for you. Free of charge. We will even supply the coffee. That's how much we love the idea of you coming. That's pretty enticing, isn't it? Wow, I don't even have to pay rent. They love us here. Wonderful. And we might actually start out that way. And then you've been there about 3 years, and every anniversary the minister talks at you to say how happy you are in our group. And then he comes to the group one night and he said, listen, our membership's falling off in the church itself. Mind if I make a little pitch during your meeting to maybe see if some of you AA members would like to join the church itself? After all, you are here every week. Now, you haven't paid any rent and you're getting free coffee. It's harder to say no, isn't it? It's a lot harder to say no. But if you've paid no minutes when we first started, we go, no, sir, we're going to come up with a rent amount. Whatever we come up with, it isn't the amount, it's the fact that we are insisting on it. $50 a month, whatever it is. And then we pay it every month. We have a check written out to the church. And we decline the coffee offer. We might not even use their coffee pots. We go buy our own coffee pots. It is to symbolize this. We are responsible for ourselves. We want to take responsibility. And it went all the way up to AA and people in their wills leaving large amounts of money. And the idea of turning it down, that it will cause us to lose our perspective. It'll change the way we see things. You want to see a problem. Have an AA group collect a lot more money than it needs and not send it anywhere. And all of a sudden the group has, let's pick the number, $2,000 in it. And then the word gets out, you know, we got $2,000 in our group. Well, let's sit down and figure out what we ought to do with that. Wouldn't that be tempting? What do you think we ought to do with that? Well, you know, it's too hot in here. We ought to get an air conditioner. That's what we ought to do with it. No, I think we ought to send it up to New York. Up to New York? That isn't going to help me. I'm hot. Why would we send it up to New York? Well, I think we ought to get decaf coffee. We haven't had any. And, you know, maybe we could hire somebody to make the coffee, and then I won't have to come in here. Screw you. You ain't getting air conditioned. I'm not coming back. All over what? Money. All over money. I could see us here right now. We're taking sides. What do you mean, don't send it to New York? Somebody over here going, I hate being hot. New York's got plenty of money. They're getting the book revenue now. Screw them. Do you see what happens? Do you see? So these were written by people with character defects who didn't want the character defects to win. That's what this is all about, is to prevent us from ruining our own heaven, as Bob was talking about, by being in charge, by being in charge. There's a great deal of humility in these traditions. There's a great lack of ego all the way throughout them, starting with the one that Bob talked about with unity. That AA is more important than me. It starts right there. And as a matter of fact, everything else is really designed to preserve what he was talking about, the unity. And certainly this one is fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. That's what gives the group its autonomy, which is a very important thing within Alcoholics Anonymous, where nobody can come to a group and say, wait a minute, you can't have 12 speakers during an AA meeting. Well, that's the name of our group, the 12 speaker group. What do you mean you can't have 12 speakers? They all talk 5 minutes and then we go home. Nobody can come, some AA policeman, and go, you can't have a 12 speaker group. They just go, well, that's a stupid idea. I won't be going there. But they are going to do it the way they want. And that's where the autonomy comes from, is we're managing our own affairs. Okay, Tradition 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should forever remain non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Now, as Bob was talking about in Tradition 6, we're not going to endorse anything outside of AA. The early plans for Alcoholics Anonymous, when you study the history, mostly Bill. You know, Bill was the idea man, and Bob was the put the blanket over the idea man before he before he runs off and sells AA to Hollywood. You know, they say, oh, boy, I got some ideas, because he was a Wall Street guy and a promoter, and so was Hank Parkhurst, his partner. And they promote. They didn't know anything about a program of attraction. It was promote. And his original plan, I mean, when he called those first 20 guys together, and they said, you know, we've got something here. We should start spreading this. And his plan was very simple. We need paid missionaries. And we need a chain of drunk tanks or hospitals. AA paid missionaries and AA chain of hospitals. And we need a book. Those were the three things that were necessary in Bill's mind to get this thing off the road. And so you could see right off from the bat, it was going to be professional. We're going to paid missionaries. And of course, nobody would give them money. It was God that was blocking Bill's plan. It wasn't Bill changing his mind. He'd go there, I got this great plan, you know, AA, we're going to sober up the world. How about donating some money? No, I think I'll give it to the Boy Scouts. No, no, no. And everywhere he went, he was blocked from getting any money, so we had to spread the word on our own in a non-professional way, and it worked. Slowly, but it worked. And it established something that may not have been visible from the start, that an alcoholic will listen to a non-professional more than they would to a professional. So when you go through treatment and the counselor is giving a lecture, there's a whole different energy than when you get a sponsor. And the sponsor is there because he loves you and isn't getting paid. And you go, why would he spend all this time with me? And we get come all the way back to the entire point of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is one drunk talking to another, which is what Bob said right in the very beginning. Everything else in Alcoholics Anonymous is designed to ensure and support one drunk talking to another. Nothing replaces that. Everything else just helps that. It helps that to happen. It creates phones and intergroups so that the alcoholic is put in touch with the person who's going to talk to him, the one-on-one. That's what everything else is for. That's why we have conferences. That's why we talk about traditions. We're going to keep this entire system working, but the system gets no one sober. The only sobriety happens one drunk talking to another. I don't care what we'd like to think. Oh, yeah, we had this great big convention, 2,000 people came there, and 57 of them were saved. No. 57 of them might have said, well, maybe I'll talk to somebody. And then it happened. And so you can see how important the non-professional. Now, having established that, there then came the controversy when treatment centers and outside people were trying to help with the disease of alcoholism, and they saw that some of the people who could be hired as an employee happened to be members of AA. What better person to train to be an alcohol counselor at a treatment center than an alcoholic? It would be a very wonderful thing. They could go back and do some studying, and then they could do whatever the treatment center wanted them to do, but they're not doing 12-step work. And if we want to have an intergroup where the phones are manned all day long and people come in, buy literature, they'll type up the list of meetings, they'll do all kinds of things, organize a convention, whatever, it's only normal to have paid employees there. Who's going to work for nothing? Not going to sit in that office all month for no pay. Well, who would be a good person to do that? Maybe a member of AA. So while that member of AA is in the office answering the phones, arranging for one alcoholic to talk to another, they are not doing 12-step work. So it's perfectly okay for them to be paid. But in the beginning, you used to hear this in the 60s, especially when the treatment centers really started taking off. Oh, you know, look at, there's Ralph. He's getting paid for 12-step work. Look at that, Ralph. You know, obviously, we had run out of stuff to gossip about. Nobody was getting divorced, or nobody was having an affair, and, you know, so... Hey, Ralph, did you hear me? You know, you just run out of gossip. You got to find some. So there it was. And Bill put all this to rest in this tradition and carefully in the central office in New York. It's manned by alcoholics and non-alcoholics. But those are jobs. They are not 12-step work. So that clearly was established in Tradition 8. Okay, Tradition 9. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. And sometimes when I'm talking about the traditions, I like to start out by saying AA is so big now. I mean, it's in 130 countries, and I don't know... 200,000 groups and 4 million miracles. And I mean, now you don't hardly have a TV show that doesn't have a subplot with somebody going to an AA meeting. You know what I mean? It's just everywhere, so everybody really knows about it. And so if you were a sociology student, you might suddenly go, they ought to have a college course on AA. What is this social phenomenon? What is it? What is this? So you're a student. And you come and you go, could someone please explain this phenomenon of Alcoholics Anonymous? So who's in charge, please? God, like Bob said. Well, but How do you determine your members? How does that set up? Because I hear there's a lot of members. Oh, the members decide. If they decide they're a member, they are. Oh, you're not involved in the process? You, AA? No, no, no. They decide that they're a member. We don't have anything to say about it. Oh, really? That sounds backwards. That's just quite amazing. Well, who's in charge? Well, we already covered that. Well, how do we donate to it? How do you get your money? Oh, we pass the basket. That's it? You just pass the basket? How do you run a budget? How do you know anybody's going to put anything? We don't. Haven't got a clue. Well, what are the treasurers? How do you sit down? How do you know you're going to have the rent money? Faith. What, but that's not, nobody else is organized like that. Are you sure this can work? All right, well, how is it organized? That's what I'd like to know. There must be an incredible organization for something that loose to function. Oh, yes, let me read. AA as such ought never be organized. That's our basic guideline for organization. At this time, the kid is going back to the school, and I don't think we want to do a course on Alcoholics Anonymous because it's not true. It doesn't exist, and they don't have all those things. And it's just a rumor that there's... It's in 125 countries because it couldn't be based on the principles that they use. No one is in charge of anybody. There is no one in an eight, like Bob said, they've voted somebody out. Clarence got voted out. I've written a book on Clarence Snyder. He was such a dynamo and controversial and everything, and breaking his anonymity, and so the members of his home group held a meeting without him there and voted him out. Said, you're no longer a member of this group. And he said, okay, but I'm still coming. The only requirement is a desire. I still have the desire, and I'm going to sit right here as a non-member. Well, then they realized what a joke it was, that you can't do that. There's no one that could enforce this. There's no one in charge. There's no one that can tell anyone else in AA what to do. A delegate can't come to a group and go, as the delegate from this area, you can't run a group like this. They go, well, watch this. We'd run it that way. What AA can do, as they do in the tradition Bob was talking about, they could send a letter and they could say, it's come to our attention that your policies in this group are such and such, like a group in Richmond that was serving beer. Now, the other groups were going nuts. But you got to realize back then, when you drank whiskey and you got beer free. Your daughter shot a whiskey, and they go, what do you want, wine, beer, or ginger ale or some soft drink? Chaser. So it was seen as just a chaser. So these guys, just starting the group, well, we'll just have beer. And, of course, they wanted to stop it. All the other groups, can you believe it? There's going to be beer over there. Well, no one could stop it. However, it did stop itself. No one could remember what night of the week the meeting was, and it fell by the wayside of its own weight as being a bad idea. Now, the letter that came would be suggesting it was a bad idea, and it probably isn't going to work, but if you didn't want to read the letter from General Service Office advising you to the contrary, the letter would simply say, it's our experience. In other words, we've heard of a group in Holland that tried that. We heard of one in South Africa, and it didn't work there. We just thought we'd pass it on to you. So you can see there's no one in charge, no one in authority in AA at all. And yet AA works. It's got to be organized somehow. Yes, there are jobs that have to be done. There are committees to put on this conference. and volunteers go, I'd like to be on that. No one can force you to be on it. Not like at work where they go, okay, you three are on this committee and you three are on that committee. It's voluntary. So as we get all these volunteers, then we might elect among ourselves somebody to be in charge of our decorations committee to hold the meeting so that we can decide what kind of decorations we want. And this is what where the only organizational part of Alcoholics Anonymous is in the volunteer, in the servant area, so that we can get things done that will enhance one alcoholic talking to another. That's what it all comes back to. We need the more pamphlets. Somebody said this might help. Somebody with a handicap. We'll write about handicapped alcoholics, and that'll help someone with a handicap, or a gay person, or a black person, or an American Indian. I mean, they try to come up with all the differences that we have. Old people. Now they're writing one on old people. I feel like writing in. We don't need any help. I know I'm old. What are you writing a pamphlet on old people for? There's probably somebody being helped, in spite of my judgment that we don't need it. You follow what I'm saying? And so the only organizational structure is in service, which ties in with the entire thrust of spirituality and humility. How should we organize the servants in order to get the service work done? You know, in New York, I don't know if they still do it, but when I took my first tour of the office up there, there are, I forget how, Bob may be able to correct me, there's like seven key positions, literature, loaners, conventions, organizing the general service conference. So there's these staff people that have these key positions. Every year, they move over one office. Now I'm in charge of loaners, just to make sure you aren't the expert at, you follow what I'm saying? Which would happen? I've been 10 years in this, and now I am. I'm just a servant like everybody else, and next year I'll be serving over there. It's almost rotating like we do rotating. I hate it when they tell me I can't make coffee anymore. I love having the key, open the room, and make the coffee. I don't know why, but that's my favorite job. And I got it now. I have a Monday night where I'm doing that, but I know it's been almost a year and they're going to be coming. But you know what I do, and I shouldn't admit to this, but maybe somebody takes it over and after a couple months they go, I hate coming here, Earl. I said, I'll take it over for you. Then I get another year. I don't think that's in the traditions, but they haven't caught me yet. Okay, where was I? 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name not never be drawn into public controversy. Bob was talking about this, but I wanted to go into it in a little more detail because the story really dramatizes this tradition. And the story really begins many, many years ago when six guys were drinking in a bar. If you haven't heard this story, it's a good one. And these guys were middle-aged. They were very successful businessmen. They had families. They were happy. They had money. But they all knew that they were alcoholics and that they were going to lose it. They could feel their disease, and they used to kid each other. You know, Joe, you're going to lose your business and your wife. My wife told me that your wife is thinking of leaving. Yeah, your wife told me that my wife is thinking, they saw the handwriting on the wall. And so one of them one day said, this was back when pledges were big, the temperance movement was running all around the country. And one of them said, I'm going to come up with a pledge. I'm going to write it myself. And then we'll all take it. and we'll see if the six of us in our pledge can stay sober. So he wrote up a pledge. We, the undersigned, do swear, solemnly swear in front of God and all our witnesses that I will never take another drink of intoxicating alcohol for the rest of my life. And then they all signed it, and they started staying sober just from the pledge. And then other guys, and so then they went out and they knew somebody else that was in trouble, and they said, Fred, you ought to come join, sign our pledge. So the entire program was the pledge. And they made a big deal out of it. They would have a ceremony in town. Now we have 10 pledge takers. Anybody else want to be on the pledge? And they would look for somebody like the mayor and get him to sign the pledge. And then lots of other people. And at the end of the first year in this city, in Baltimore, they had a parade with a band. And all the pledgers are walking down. And I don't know, I think they had something like 500. 500 of these guys just taking the pledge and staying sober. And then the original guy was such an organizer. He says, all right, now you go up to New York and take this pledge up there and get a bunch of people. And you go over to Pennsylvania. And he sent different guys that had taken the pledge. And they started this thing. And they were looking for a name. And they said, well, we want something that'll make it really important. And, of course, nothing could be more important at that time, you know, in the 1840s and 50s, than George Washington. I mean, that was the name. So they said, we'll call ourselves the Washingtonian Society after George. And that'll get us a lot more people in. And as Bob said, in a matter of a very few years, the numbers I saw was 400,000 people had taken the pledge. And it was in city all over the place. It had a bigger percentage of the population in their movement than AA does now in the United States. We're nowhere near that percentage of the population that they had. And when you have amassed a large number of people, outside forces look and they go, that's a potential power base. You follow what I'm saying? AA would be a very big power base. I mean, if I had a product and I wanted to sell it and I said AA endorsed it, there's a lot of AA members that might buy it. You follow what I'm saying? So wouldn't it be nice if I could get AA? So we had the endorsement thing that Bob was talking about, but this is more, why would I be tempted to do that? Well, I believe in that, what they want me to endorse. I like the idea. And one of the issues was slavery. This was just leading up to the Civil War. And not drinking, prohibition. We get those two things. What could be more God's will than wiping out this horrible thing called slavery and wiping out this terrible thing called alcohol that is killing and ruining the lives of all these people? Very tempting to get involved and to take an opinion on a noble cause. And as Bob said, within 4 years, they were gone. It divided. They just disappeared. Took them away from their primary purpose. Oh, primary purpose, stay sober and straighten out South Africa. You follow what I'm saying? Well, just pick something. Pick your favorite cause. Stay sober and goodbye. They were gone so much that when Bill was writing the traditions, someone said, well, Bill, you ought to look into the history of the Washingtonians. Maybe there's some lessons there for you. And he had never heard of them. That's how far they had disappeared. They're just gone. So if they ever went, it would be gone. You know, when you're gone, you're gone. You don't hardly see anybody running around with hula hoops. I remember when everybody had one. But when they're gone, they're gone. It's just, they're gone. And I don't want to see AA gone. And so that's what this is, an opinion. Just an opinion. Now, in order to have opinion, you have to be willful. It's the only way to have an opinion. I'm right and they're wrong. You know how that goes? I'm right and they're wrong. An opinion. Very unspiritual thing. Just the opposite of God's will. Who wants to give up your opinions? Not me. Well, then you can't let go and let God. You can't hold on to any of those and be guided by your higher power. Kind of hard, isn't it? In the 70s, when, Harold Hughes from Iowa was a U.S. senator and a recovered alcoholic, and he's the man who decided that there ought to be a law passed making alcoholism a disease and allowing insurance companies to cover treatment of this disease in a hospital, much like other diseases are covered. In other words, it's to make it a disease and therefore eligible for medical help. It would legitimize it. It would make it so that you don't have to be ashamed. It would help in many, many ways. So he got the law passed, and that was the first time that Congress got involved in an alcohol issue other than prohibition, an alcoholism issue. And they created the National Institute on Alcohol and Alcohol Abuse, which Marty Mann had actually started. And so all this happened out of that. Well, about 8 years later, in the Health and Human Services Committee of the U.S. Senate, one senator, I forget who it was, I was working as a lobbyist back then, they came up with, we ought to put warning labels on alcohol like we do on cigarettes. You know, because if it was there, I mean, I don't know how you feel about labels. I don't read them myself, but that was the bill. And they were having hearings on should we put warning labels. And one of the committee staff said, I'll tell you who is the perfect source to get an opinion on putting warning labels on bottles, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me call the central office in New York, General Services, and see if they could send somebody down. They said, yeah, we'll send somebody down to talk to you. So they sent a staff person down, and they got them in the committee staff room, and they said, listen, here's what we're going to do. What would AA think about this idea? And they looked at him and said, oh, we have no opinion whatsoever on that. No. But it's alcohol. It's, you guys all drank bottles, 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 bottles. I mean, who would know more about that than you? And they said, we have no opinion whatsoever on putting label on a bottle. And went back to New York, and then they went back to the senators, and they said, they have no opinion whatsoever. I think the originator of the bill was insulted. He felt we were saying his bill wasn't important. But that was in the record, that AA had no opinion on this. That's not to say that individual AA members don't have opinions. We can have opinions all over the place. And I have an opinion on that issue, and I'm going to share it with you right now. I believe there should be warning labels on alcohol bottles, and I know what it should say so that it'll do some good. This is what the label should say. Warning. This bottle may run out. You should consider buying two. And then we won't have alcoholics going home. They thought they had enough. They finish the bottle. It's midnight. They don't have enough. They get in their car. They're drunk. They're going back to get a second bottle. They get a DWI. They had the second bottle, they wouldn't have done that, so we'd finally have a label that would do some good. So opinions, opinions. I mean, how wonderful to have an organization that has no opinions on anything except one drunk helping another. Again, eliminating controversy, keeping us focused, focus, focus on being a servant, focused on God, focused on the most important thing we could ever do in our lives. The last two traditions have to do with anonymity, and I'll wrap them up, and we'll be out of here in 7 minutes. Public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We always need to maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And when you read the tradition book or the AA history, anonymity and the wonderful value that we have came about as a result of fear. There was this fear. It was the unknown. When you're getting sober and starting something like this to go help drunks who are not looked on too kindly by society, you want to keep it secret. You know what I'm saying? Let's not brag. Let's not go all over. Somebody might shut us down. And then the other fear was, look, there's only five of us, and we know there's like 9 million alcoholics in America. What if the word got out and 9 million guys showed at our door? There wouldn't be enough of us to help them. So let's keep it a secret. We'll call ourselves Alcoholics Anonymous. No names. Nobody will be able to find us at home, you know, and get 60,000 calls a night. None of this was true, but when you have fears, you have big ones. And so that's what was going on in the beginning. And then, as it started to unfold, they realized the power of anonymity on two levels. One was on making it a program of attraction rather than promotion. And Bob talked about the Jack Alexander story, where this guy came to investigate AA. He found out what it was, and he went out and told the good news to the world. It wasn't AA telling the good news. It was a skeptical reporter. I went there, and let me tell you what I found. So a program of attraction relies on others to tell our story. And the Cleveland Plain Dealer, perhaps one of the greatest events to tell the AA story was the John D. Rockefeller, black tie dinner in 1941 in New York City, where he invited all the elite, all the top bankers, the church people, the cream of the crop in New York City to come to a dinner honoring AA. He got a lot of criticism. He must be off his rocker. Black tie dinner for drunks? What is that? And it was in all the papers. And what it did, it legitimized the disease of alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous in one big story. And so our story is told by others. And it's so amazing. Think about this. I don't know if you've observed this, but I think in the last 20 years, there's an element in the press that delights in digging up dirt. Maybe I'm wrong, but it just seems that way. Well, if I was one of those reporters and I wanted to dig up dirt with no effort whatsoever, I would just park out in front of AA meetings and see, oh, there's the mayor's assistant. Bingo. I could have enough stories to go on for, I'd never have to work. I'd just go down to the intergroup office, get the meeting list, pull up to the meetings, and watch. And I have all the stories I want. And they don't do it. How do you like that? They'll do it everywhere except AA. Isn't that amazing? They understand this tradition sometimes better than we do. Sometimes our own members want to go, and I'm also a member of AA. And the newspaper editor says, take out the sentence where he said he was a member of AA. Because we understand. When they had this tradition, they wrote to all the newspapers in the country, and they said, we want to maintain anonymity, at personal anonymity, at the level of press, radio, and films. And it is amazing what that desire for no publicity did in terms of getting publicity. Let me tell you about the people that don't want publicity. What a story that is. Here's people that don't want any attention. They just want to help drunks. How could you tell that story yourself and be believed? I'm holding this press conference to let you know that we're only interested in helping drunks. My name is Sandy Beach. You want me to stand this way? Okay, good. You see the difference? It's a wonderful, powerful thing, this maintaining and the relationship between AA and the press that came about almost accidental. The last one, what they discovered out of here, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. They realized, as they did this, the importance of not being anything. They realized that when you say, someone asks you, who are you? Now, if you're somebody who's successful here in San Francisco and someone outside of AA says, who are you? Tell them, Joe, you've just sat down here with five other guys. We don't really know each other. Who are you? You would go, well, I went over here to the college in San Francisco. I studied this. I wrote these three books. I'm on the board of directors of a blah, 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 and the beep, and about, and I go to this church, and I give talks on this, and I also am, and I am also an expert engineer, and I've blah, 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 and that's who I am. You follow what I'm saying? Now, what is that? That's ego. That's who I am. You see what I'm saying? It's a big thing. Look about a resume. You're looking for a job, so you've read a resume. What do you put on a resume? Everything that will get you more. Hey, don't forget, put those three courses you put down. Might be worth $5,000 a year. Oh, yeah. And we pump that thing up, and we pump it up, and we pump it up, and when we got this piece of paper in front of us, we go, this is what I'm entitled to. You see the energy as a resume goes out? Now, let's say we come and run everything through AA. And we come in here and we go, well, who are you? Oh, I'm Fred. I'm an alcoholic. That's it, Fred? Yeah, that's about it. And we know you better than if we read your resume. You told us everything we need to know. You see what I'm saying? You told us you're interested in helping others. You're not interested in yourself. You don't even care about telling us that you happen to own half of San Francisco. That's not me. I'm Fred, an alcoholic. I'm Fred. You know what the freedom it is for Fred to just be an alcoholic and not be all the rest of that stuff? What a great freedom to just come in here and just be another guy, another gal. I'm just another gal here. I don't have to be all those other things. And Bill saw the great freedom in being anonymous. And so the next time we take a look at a resume and we go, what's on that resume? Oh, what's on this resume is a list of all of the attributes that God gave me that enables me to be useful to the place where I work. Here's a list of the things I can do for your company. That's what this list is. Wow. A lot of different energy going out of that resume. See, it's going the other way. It doesn't ask for anything coming back. It just wants to share service of God-given skills and trust that God will take care of us. And Bob ran his business that way, and his business was better than if he tried to make a lot of money. And your career will be better than if you tried to advance yourself. That is trust in anonymity. Okay, we're at the end of the time. I don't know how we're going to wrap this up, but I'm going to sit down and thank you for your attention. I appreciate it.
We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in other speaker tapes or CDs from AA or Al-Anon, please contact us at Sound Solutions, toll free 1-877-893-2777, or visit us on the web at soundsolutionsrecording.com. We are also available to cover your recording and sound system needs. Thank you for allowing us to be of service and carrying the message.